1 Corinthians 2:16, the second talk in a series titled Reading the Book, Lessons in Understanding the Bible, was presented by Ron Julian on April 10, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Okay, we're going to start up here. This is session two in our series called Reading the Book. What we're trying to do is pick some passages to look at that we think illustrate various principles involved with being better readers of the Bible. This is not a systematic approach. This is certainly not everything you need to know about being a good Bible student, but my conviction, our conviction here really is, for many of us, what we need to do is get kind of a picture of what it's supposed to look like. We have had experiences, perhaps, where people grab verses out of context and run with them. And what we're trying to do is give you a feel for a different way of dealing with the Bible, a way that tries to pay a lot more attention to what is it that the biblical authors were actually talking about. When Paul wrote a letter, when Jesus preached a sermon, what was he saying? What was the issue? Okay, so last week, we sort of looked at a passage in 1 Corinthians that illustrated the importance of putting ourselves into the situation of the readers. We talked about some of the background information to the letter, and we were looking for the situation into which Paul was speaking. What was on his mind? What was the problem into which he was speaking? And we talked a little bit about the situation there. The Corinthians, many of them didn't think so highly of Paul. They thought in particular that he was not a good speaker. He was not a wise man in their terms because they found his speech unimpressive. And we saw how it was very likely that they thought more highly of Apollos because he was a very eloquent man and a good debater, which was very highly valued in much of Greek culture. Today, I want to look at another passage right there in 1 Corinthians to illustrate another point, another aspect of being careful readers of the Bible. Tonight, I want to focus on one particular sentence. In chapter 2, verse 16, Paul says, "We have the mind of Christ." So, I would like to talk about that verse and see if we can figure out what it is that Paul has in mind when he says it. This is a verse that I've heard kicked around a lot as a Christian. I have been taught things like, well, obviously here this is talking about the supernatural empowerment of all believers. As believers, we have been supernaturally endowed with all the knowledge of Christ himself. We have the mind of Christ. What he knows, we know. Now, why is it that we may not feel that we know all of that or that we don't have that knowledge? Well, we're not exercising the faith appropriate to appropriating that knowledge. If we would just believe, though, if we would avail ourselves of the power of God working within us, we really have no need to study or be taught because we have access to all the knowledge of Christ already. We have the mind of Christ, a supernatural empowerment, whereas what Christ knows, we know. Now, not everyone who teaches on this passage would say that, but many have, and I have heard it from a variety of sources. The question is whether that is in fact what Paul has on his mind. Is that true? Do we as believers know everything that Christ knows if we could only get access to it somehow? Or does Paul have something else in mind? Let me read the passage that we're going to be looking at tonight. We're in chapter 2 of 1 Corinthians. I want to start with verse 6. Yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature, a wisdom, however, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away, but we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom, which God predestined before the ages to our glory, the wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood, for if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But just as it is written, things which eye has not seen and ear has not heard, and which have not entered the heart of man, all that God has prepared for those who love him. For to us God revealed them through the Spirit, for the Spirit searches all things, even the depths of God. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. Now we have received, not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. But a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them, because they are spiritually appraised. But he who is spiritual appraises all things, yet he himself is appraised by no man. For who has known the mind of the Lord that he should instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. All right. Well, I have a particular purpose in mind tonight. There is one major point that I would like to make from this passage. I will consider this evening successful if I have made my major point. I'm shooting for a secondary goal as well, which is that you come away with some idea of what it is I think this passage is saying. I'm hoping that I'm able to accomplish my secondary goal. This is a complicated passage, and I'm not going to be able tonight to talk about all of the things that need to be talked about to convince you that I'm looking at it the right way. I want to use this as kind of a model for a particular issue and suggest some things to you, and I'm going to leave you to ask me questions or go away and hammer on it yourself and think about whether the direction I'm trying to steer you is the direction that you ought to go. There's a particular point that I want to bring out tonight that's very important when it comes to reading the Bible. And since we were in the context of 1 Corinthians from last week, and this is a passage that illustrates this point, I thought we would look at this one tonight. There is a very common error that we can make when we come to the Bible. And it's an error that can be motivated by a very right attitude. I come to the Bible and I want the Bible to speak to me. I want the Bible to tell me how I should think about my life. I want the Bible to tell me what I should do and how I should think and what God thinks of me and what God wants for me. I mean, all of us do. Of course we do. I mean, the Bible is not just an abstract book of philosophical ideas. It is talking about God and his relationship to his people, and I am very concerned with the questions like, am I one of God's people, and what is it that God wants me to do, and so on. So, the problem that we run into, though, is that when we come to the Bible, it's very easy for us to come to the Bible with our own particular set of questions, saying, I want the Bible to answer this question. The problem when we do that is that we can end up making the text say something that it wasn't saying. Because unfortunately, although I'm trying to make the text answer this question, in fact, Paul or Jesus or whoever meant to answer this question over here. How can we guard against that? I mean, well, there are a lot of aspects to it, but one aspect of that is what I want to talk about tonight. There's this this error, we hear language like, you may have heard this sort of language, the Bible is God's love letter to me. Now, I'm not denying that there's a very real sense in which that's true. I mean, there is a message in the Bible, and that message is intended for me, ultimately. It is one that I need to come to terms with, and it is a message from God, and it is a message that is intended for me to deal with. But when I have that phrase, the Bible is God's love letter to me, I can fall into this mistake, because when I get a love letter from somebody else and they're writing that letter directly to me. And so when they say things like you and we and all of that, I know who they're talking about. They're talking about me. They're talking about us. Of course. I mean, who else would it be? It's written to me. So, of course, I'm just plastered all over this thing. Well, the problem is that, for instance, when we look at 1 Corinthians, it's very important for us to make the assessment in our mind, first of all, that this was not written to us. I mean, is its message ultimately relevant to us? Absolutely. It is a life and death message that is absolutely relevant to us. But was it written to us? No. It was written to the Corinthians in a particular situation, talking about particular things. So, paying attention to who is this written to, and who is talking, and what is being talked about, that's a very important question. Now, so the very simple sort of question that I want to talk about tonight, this is the simple part of it. When Paul says, we have the mind of Christ, I want to ask the question, who is we? When he says, we have the mind of Christ, who is we? I think all of us, when we read it at first, assume that the we is we Christians. Well, that's very possible. The fact is, we could read this section and make sense of it as talking about we Christians. We do speak wisdom among those who are mature. Well, every believer has an understanding of the gospel, and when we proclaim the gospel and talk about it in the world, those who are mature recognize it as wisdom, we could say. All right. Paul's, to us God revealed them through the Spirit. We have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God. Okay, well, we all know that we as believers have received the Spirit. We have the Spirit of God in us. So, very natural. He's talking about us. The Spirit has come to us and revealed the truths of God. Each believer has had the truths of God revealed to him by the Spirit. And then finally, when we come to the end, we have the mind of Christ. Great. There's just another way of describing it. The truths of God have been supernaturally imparted to us through the Spirit so that we know what Christ knows. I could read it that way, and I could make a certain amount of sense out of it. I could come away and say, okay, great, so I have this picture. The picture is that the Spirit of God has come to every believer and revealed the truth to us, and we have been supernaturally empowered to know all the truths of God. They have been poured out into our mind and understanding through the Spirit of God. And maybe that's the kind of thing that Paul has in mind. However, there's something that I want to call your attention to tonight. This is the main thing that I wanted to get across to you. And it has to do with that handout that I gave you. Because there's something that we have to consider when we come to a text like this. It's going to force us to make a decision about what it is Paul is doing. And what I have called it here, Paul's use of the royal we, which is a term that many people use to talk about this sort of thing, because they call it the royal we because it is not uncommon for kings, for royalty, to say, you know, we are not amused. You know, we decree that this is going to happen. And, of course, all the time when the king is saying, we decree this, he means I decree this. So the royal we is this phrase that we have come to apply to any situation where somebody uses the word we in the plural, where essentially what they're talking about is themselves personally in the singular. What we need to understand, we here together, not just me, but all of us, what we need to understand is that Paul very, very, very often uses the word we when he essentially means I, himself. There are various reasons why he might do that. Sometimes he may be sort of implying that he and the other apostles, sort of, you know, bringing the other apostles in with him. Sometimes he may be implying a little bit I am the person who's writing this letter with me. You know, sometimes his letters are addressed not just from Paul, but from Paul and Timothy, or from Paul and Silvanus and Timothy, or, you know, sometimes his letters are, they have more than one name on them. And so sometimes that we might sort of include the people that are writing with him. But then there are some times when it looks pretty clear that he doesn't really mean anything, anybody else except himself. When he says we, he means I. Now, I gave you a list here. This is just an abridged list. I have pages and pages of this stuff. That Paul does this all the time. I mean, he uses we when he's talking about himself on many occasions. We can just point you to a couple of examples on here. You can notice in Romans 1:5 in his introduction, he says, "Through whom we have received grace and apostleship to bring about the obedience of faith among all the Gentiles." This is his introduction to his letter, which basically starts out saying that it's from Paul. And yet, even though it's from Paul, he says, "We have received grace and apostleship." About a quarter of the way down, 2 Corinthians 3:1, "Are we beginning to commend ourselves again? Or do we need, as some, letters of commendation to you or from you?" In that passage, Paul is talking to the Corinthians about himself, about his ministry among them. And he has been defending himself. And yet at that spot he says, "Are we beginning to commend ourselves again?" Clearly, we here doesn't mean we Christians, because he's distinguishing between we and you. There's we, are we commending ourselves again? Or do we need to send a letter of recommendation to you? There's we, and then there's you. There are places here where, kind of right in the middle, if you look at 2 Corinthians 7:13-14, notice he says, "For this reason we have been comforted. And besides our comfort, we rejoiced even much more for the joy of Titus, because his spirit has been refreshed by you all. For if anything I have boasted to him about you, I was not put to shame, but as we spoke all things to you in truth, so also our boasting before Titus proved to be the truth." And what's interesting in that passage is notice that first he talks about how I boasted, but the next time he talks about it, he calls it our boasting. So, I would invite you to look through this list, and I'm not lying. There are many more. I just picked a number of them, and when they filled up the page, then I stopped. Paul has quite a consistent habit of using the word we when he means himself. There can be no question about that, I think. We all need to recognize that that's the case. Now, that being the case, we as students of the Bible then need to be careful. When Paul starts talking about how we do things and we have things, we have a question, we ourselves here together have a question that we have to answer. Is he talking about himself, or is he talking about believers in general? Does he ever use we to mean believers in general? Yes, he does. Does he ever use we in distinction from other believers to mean himself? Yes, he does. So we have this choice that we've got to make. Now, one of the reasons I'm highlighting this choice is because, as I said before, if we take the Bible is God's love letter to me attitude, then every time we see we, it's possible that we will jump to the conclusion that we are the ones being talked about. I mean, what good is it to me if Paul is talking about himself? He's gone. That's all over and done with now. But if I am the one, if we includes me, if we is a group that is all believers, then anything that's true of this group that Paul said back there is going to be true of me now. And because we really have this inclination, we want the Bible to be speaking to us, we are inclined to go that way too quickly. That's the point that I want to make to you tonight. That you and I, if we are going to be careful students of the Bible, we need to step back and let Paul say what he's saying and recognize that he may not be doing what we would like him to be doing. He may have something on his mind that is not what is on our minds. And one of the things we have to be paying attention to is, who is he talking about? Is he talking about Christians in general? Is he talking about himself? Is he talking about the apostles? Is he talking about himself and the particular group in the church that he's writing to? I know that's not a real jazzy and exciting and dynamic and life-changing sort of question, it doesn't seem like, but it's exactly the kind of question that you have to ask if you want to understand what Paul is saying. So, as is often going to be true in this class, part of what we want to get across is, if we're serious about understanding what the Bible is saying, then we have to be prepared for it to be saying things different and talking about different subjects than we would like it to be talking about. Okay. Now, in this passage then, asking the question, who is the we in this passage, we've already seen that we could make some sort of reasonable sense out of it if we were talking about the we being we Christians. But the question is that what he means? Is it we Christians that he has in mind in this passage? Let's go back through, and I want to look at this now from the perspective that the we that he's talking about here is really himself. And I want to work this through and see what we end up with. First of all, why would we think that such a thing might be true? If we look at the context, if we look at the whole letter, especially the first like four chapters here in 1 Corinthians, we see a couple of themes that keep emerging. Paul has been talking here as we come through chapter 1 and into chapter 2 about how he speaks a gospel which is true wisdom from God. In 1:17, as we saw last week, Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in cleverness of speech, that the cross of Christ should not be made void. Paul's talking about the way he chose to speak. Why is it that he was preaching the gospel rather than using cleverness of speech? Wisdom of speech, actually, is literally what he says there. Why is that? Because as he says, the word of the cross is to those who are perishing foolishness, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? And basically, Paul's message there is, look, I didn't come with persuasive words of wisdom, that sort of thing, because I have a gospel to proclaim, which is the true wisdom. The world thinks it's foolish, but God thinks the world is foolish because through its wisdom it didn't come to know God. We may be really smart about all kinds of things, but the fact is, in all our smartness, we have missed God. So God is not all that impressed with our wisdom. And it doesn't bother him all that much that the people of this world tend to look at the gospel and think it's foolish. Of course they think it's foolish. I mean, they're not thinking about things right. So Paul, in the section before this, is trying to convince the Corinthians, look, what I proclaim, this gospel that I speak, is the true wisdom from God. As he comes into chapter 2, he talks again about how he chose to speak when he was there. When I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God, for I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. My message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. And so now, we come in to the passage that we're concerned with, yet we do speak wisdom among those who are mature. Well, I hope you can see that it's a pretty reasonable alternative when I get to that spot to think that when he talks about we do speak wisdom among those who are mature, since he has been talking all this time about how, about his message, his gospel, and how he chose to speak when he was among them, that that's still what he has on his mind. You notice in chapter 3, when we get out of the passage that we're looking at, the first thing he says is, "And I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual men, but as to men of flesh, as to babes in Christ." Again, he's talking about how he spoke to them. So, before this passage, he's talking about how he spoke to them. And after the passage, he's talking about how he spoke to them. So, it's pretty reasonable to think that he may still have on his mind, when he comes into this passage, his speech, the way he talks, and in particular, continuing his defense of the idea that that his speech really is the true wisdom. It may not be the wisdom that the world accepts. He had no concern to couch his message in terms that the world would find compelling and eloquent and wise. But, he says, we do speak wisdom among those who are mature. Okay, so coming into this section, we can see that Paul has on his mind very much the issue of how did he choose to speak? And is his message, in and of itself, true wisdom or not? There is another issue that Paul has on his mind as he's going through this. Clearly, he is concerned to be defending to the Corinthians the way he spoke and the fact that the gospel that he preaches is true wisdom. Some of his comments are directed right at them. "Consider your calling, brethren. There were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise," and so on. I mean, he's saying, you guys think about it. Think about your own situation. Is it that you, as a congregation of people who believe in Jesus, that you're so impressive? I mean, look around. Are you guys like the cream of the crop? Is that what the deal is here? He's saying, if you think about it, that's not the way God operates. Paul is trying to convince them of a certain perspective on this. You're not thinking about this right. You guys are not thinking about this right. And that becomes really clear as we go through these four chapters in the first part of 1 Corinthians. So, what we have as we come into this section is, on the one hand, Paul is very concerned to defend the way he speaks and the message that he proclaims as true wisdom from God. And on the other hand, he's very concerned to point out to the Corinthians the error in their perspective, the error in the way they are thinking about things. Now, we could just come to this passage and see, this is a statement that a passage that says that all Christians have been given in their minds an understanding of the gospel through the power of the Spirit. But we could step back and ask the question, what exactly does that have to do with what Paul has been talking about? If, however, we come into this and we say to ourselves at this point, the we that he's talking about is he himself, that he speaks wisdom among the mature, that he, Paul, as an apostle, his message is really wisdom from God, that's very coherent. It makes a lot of sense with what it is he's just been saying. So far, so good. I would like to suggest that's round one goes to we means Paul. That works not too bad there. Now, this is not, does that decide the issue? No. But I think, granted, of course, that I'm stacking the deck as I go along. I mean, you recognize that there's a lot more to talk about in this than we're able to talk about here. But if you'll just, for the sake of argument, recognizing that I'm stacking the deck a little bit, the fact is, that would make pretty good sense that Paul means himself. I speak wisdom among those who are mature. A wisdom, however, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away, but we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory, the wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood. For if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Clearly here, he's saying, this wisdom that we speak, that I speak, I'm saying, that Paul speaks, this wisdom is not understood by the world. This is not wisdom that the world sees as wisdom. If it had understood what was going on, the rulers of this age would not have crucified Christ. They were the powerful men. They were the ones in charge. They were the ones who would be most impressive and that the world would be most impressed with. These are the scholars. These are the political powers. These are the ones who have got it all together. And yet they looked at the Lord of glory and rejected him. That's how much they understood the wisdom of God. This wisdom, then, that I speak is a wisdom that the world has not understood. But just as it is written, things which eye has not seen and ear has not heard and which have not entered the heart of man, all that God has prepared for those who love him. This is an Old Testament passage that Paul is quoting that says, we didn't know what God was planning. We didn't understand what it is that God had on his mind, what his purposes were, the incredible work he was going to do in his creation, but God was busy preparing it and getting ready for it anyway. So here again, Paul is highlighting the fact that we as human beings don't have access to this. We don't know what God's doing. We don't know what he's thinking. We don't know what his purposes are. And the people of the world around us have foolishly misunderstood everything that they have looked at. But the fact is, although God's purposes have been hidden, they do not continue to be hidden. Because Paul says, we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom. There is this mystery. What is God up to? What is the purpose of creation? What is all of this stuff about? Paul is telling us. The message of the apostles, the gospel that they preached, tells us what God is up to, what God's purposes are, what he intends to do, what the whole story is about. For to us, God revealed them through the Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, even the depths of God. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so, the thoughts of God no one knows except the Spirit of God. Here is where we make the key decision in the whole passage. We have these two roads that we might go down. For to us, God revealed them through the Spirit. What is Paul saying? Is there a work of the Spirit in every believer? Yes, I think the Bible clearly indicates that there is a work of the Spirit in every believer. Does the Spirit of God have something to do with our coming to understand the gospel? Yes, he does. But is there also a particular work of the Spirit in the minds and hearts of the apostles, of someone like Paul? Yes, there is. Paul talks about apostleship as being a spiritual gift. It is a work of God in him. I am not an apostle. I have not had a revelation given to me from God about what God's purposes are, who Jesus is, and what he's doing in the world. Not the way Paul had. There are these two different things that the Spirit does. There is the work that the Spirit does in every believer, which we can talk about, and there is the work that the Spirit of God does individually. To one person he gives one gift, and to another person he gives another gift. And to Paul, we know, he gave the gift of being an apostle. And Paul describes that as Jesus himself personally came to him and taught him that the gospel that he got is not from man, but it is from God. You might notice in 1 Corinthians, Paul in chapter 4, he says, "Let a man regard us in this manner, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. In this case, moreover, it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. But to me it is a very small thing that I should be examined by you or by any human court." Okay, so, two very important things there. How should you think about us? You should think about us as servants of Christ, stewards of the mysteries of God. A steward, you know, is like an overseer. It's a servant who has in charge of all the master's possessions. Paul is saying, how should you think about me? I am a steward of the mysteries of God. God has given his mysteries to me, and it is my job to pass them out to everyone else. It is my job to explain and proclaim the mysteries. The things that God has never revealed before, he has revealed now, and it is my job to reveal them. Okay, do you understand the distinction I'm making here? Paul calls himself a steward of the mysteries of God. I am not a steward of the mysteries of God in that sense. God didn't come to me directly, explain to me the gospel, give me a supernaturally empowered understanding of the deep message of the gospel and send me out to proclaim it with the authority of Christ himself. That's not who I am. I am, however, a believer in whom the Spirit of God is at work, whose mind and heart is being transformed by the Spirit of God. So the question then becomes, when we come to this passage and we read something that says, "For to us God revealed them through the Spirit," what sort of a thing is Paul talking about? Is he talking about that work of the Spirit that is in each of us? Or is he talking about the mysteries of God, which he just got done talking about, that he is a steward of, that have been given to him by God? That's the fundamental choice that we face in the entire passage. And it makes a great difference which way we go. Because on the one hand, Paul is saying, God has entrusted, has given this knowledge to all of us through the Spirit. And so we are to picture somehow that somehow I have had knowledge of the purposes of God imparted to me, to my mind, by the Spirit of God directly. Or is Paul saying, I, Paul, as an apostle, have been given these mysteries of God by the Spirit? Well, I would like to pursue here the possibility that Paul is still, when he says we, is still talking about himself. Notice, if I didn't emphasize it enough when I read from verse 4, chapter 4, "Let a man regard us in this manner." There we have it again, that plural. In that section, there can't be any doubt. How should you think about me, is what he's saying. I am a steward of the mysteries of God. That's how you should think about me. But he says, us. So let's pursue then the possibility that when he says, to us God revealed them, that this is his explanation of what he started out to say. We do speak wisdom among those who are mature. Why is it that I can speak this wisdom, Paul is saying, this mystery that the world has not known? Because the Spirit of God has revealed it to me. Is that something that Paul says elsewhere? Yes, it is. In fact, it's a very strong emphasis of his. My message is not something I made up, but God has given it to me. Okay? We'll move on to verse 12. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit. Okay, notice that if we're following along and we're saying, is this talking about the Spirit of God imparting knowledge to Paul? That there's a certain amount of confirmation in what we just read there, because as he describes it, we have received these things from the Spirit of God that we might know them, which things we also speak. Well, throughout this section, the issue is, what is it that Paul is speaking? They think his speech is contemptible. They think that Apollos is much more interesting to listen to. That's what I argued last week, is at the heart the issue that ties the first four chapters of 1 Corinthians together. So here Paul is saying, you want to know how to think about what we speak? We speak wisdom. The mature understand that what we speak is wisdom. It's the hidden knowledge of God. It's the mystery that no one has understood before. How do we know this wisdom? Because the Spirit has imparted it to us. And what do we do? What do I do, Paul, when I get this wisdom? I speak it. God tells me, and I tell you. That's a very clear teaching of Paul in other places about how he pictures his role. And here, that if we forget about our desire to have this speak to us and say, this is me, I have this knowledge that has been imparted to me by the Spirit, the fact is that the whole thing makes a lot more sense if we see Paul talking about himself. Because the entire issue throughout this section is, what should the Corinthians be thinking about what Paul says? He's been defending his speech. I didn't speak eloquence or that. I spoke the gospel to you. And the fact is that if you understood what was going on, you would recognize that the gospel I speak is wisdom. I've gotten it from God, and I have passed it on to you. That's my job. Okay. Now, I face this decision here because there is an interpretive issue, an interesting interpretive issue. You're certainly going to want to know what to do with this phrase that comes up next. And do I want to talk about it or not? I'm just looking at the time and thinking about, am I going to totally confuse you if I bring this up? He says, we speak not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit. And in the New American Standard, it reads, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. What does somebody have a translation other than New American Standard that says something different than that? Expressing spiritual thoughts with spiritual words.
In spiritual words.
In spiritual words. Okay. Does anyone have another one? Okay. Comparing spiritual things with spiritual. Okay. Now, let me explain something to you. What we have here is we have a verb and two adjectives functioning as nouns. We have a verb. This can be translated in a variety of ways. The main contenders are combining, comparing, and explaining. These are all common ways of using this word. Paul uses this word only in one other place in the entire Bible. And in the other place he uses it, it means comparing. But that doesn't mean anything. When you only catch a person using a word twice, and in one of the cases you don't know what he means, and in the other case you're pretty sure he means one thing. I mean, you could catch me using the same word twice easily and say, okay, every time Ron means uses that word, he must mean this. And then the next day you'll catch me using that word in a different sense. I mean, words can have different meanings. So that doesn't really help us much. Combining, comparing, or explaining. And then we have spiritual things. It's basically, literally, let me do it like this. Basically, it's spirituals to spirituals. And that may be to, or with, or in, various things that might be there. Okay, so this is combining spirituals with spirituals, comparing spirituals to spirituals, or explaining spirituals to spirituals. That's what we have. That stuff about thoughts and words and all that kind of stuff, that's not in there at all. The translators are sticking that stuff in there to try to explain to you what they think he's doing. But there's nothing, I can just guarantee you, there's nothing about these words that makes it so that thoughts or words or anything like that ought to be going with it. Some interpreter of the text has sat there and tried to figure out what it is that Paul's saying in this context, and they decided, okay, the one that makes the most sense and the one that most of all of them seem to be going with, although actually yours was different. Most of them seem to be going with combining spirituals with spirituals. And what are the two combinings? Well, he talked about words, so let's have him, one of them be words, and then what would you combine words with? Well, okay, maybe what he's saying is the words have been given to him by God as well as the thoughts. He understands it, but God has also given him the words, and so he's combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. Something like that. That's what the translators have done. I don't mean to make you skeptical or cynical about the translations that you have, but I want to make you aware. It's just a decision. A guy like me made this decision. I mean, I'm sure that they were real smart and they were really good people, but when it comes right down to it, their decision on how to translate it is only as good as their understanding of the passage. Okay? I might comment that this spirituals here is neuter, meaning that typically it goes with, well, this is a little, with things, which is why oftentimes you'll see this translated spiritual things. And this one here is masculine, if I remember correctly. Isn't that right? I think it is. Oh, right. That's right. That's right. Okay. Right. The question is, when we get here, whether we're talking about neuter or masculine. So we have that. We could call this things, but we also could translate it something more like ones. Okay. So having said all of that stuff, having put together the context in the way that I have, I would see Paul as saying, and I'm not going to defend this to you tonight, I'm just showing you the process that we go through. I would see Paul as saying that he is explaining spiritual things to spiritual ones, that is, to spiritual people. In the context, he's just about to now to go on and compare the difference between the natural man who does not understand the things of God, and the spiritual one who does. And he starts into that discussion by saying, God has given him this understanding, he is speaking it out, and what he is doing when he is speaking it out is he is explaining spiritual things to spiritual people. That's his task. But what happens when he explains spiritual things to people who are not spiritual, people who are just what he calls natural? That's what he goes on to say. But a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. But he who is spiritual appraises all things, yet he himself is appraised by no man. Paul, as I said in the beginning, has two things on his mind. He is defending his speech, what he teaches, as being the true wisdom. And he's explained why it's the true wisdom. It has been given to him by the Spirit of God. Who knows the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God? Who else is going to know the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God? And the Spirit of God has imparted an understanding of God's purposes to Paul as an apostle. That's half of his concern. God has given me an understanding of his purposes, and I am explaining them. But remember what his other concern is. His other concern is how the Corinthians have responded to his message. And many of those Corinthians have responded by calling it foolishness. I mean, they believe in Jesus, but the Jesus they believe in isn't really the Jesus that Paul is proclaiming. Much of what Paul has to say they find uninteresting. And so here Paul is essentially sort of giving them a warning, a look at this. Okay, what I'm proclaiming is spiritual. It is from the Spirit of God, the truths of God that he has explained to me, and I'm passing them on to you. And you guys think that it's not real wisdom. Well, that's kind of too bad, because the natural man listens to the spiritual things of God and says, no way. What exactly is the problem with you guys? I mean, in essence, he's raising this issue. What I'm teaching is real wisdom, but only a spiritual person, only one in whom the Spirit of God has done his work, is going to be able to respond to the things of God. Okay, so what I would argue in this section is, instead of one simple picture, which I admit would be simpler for us to deal with, which just says the Spirit of God pours his knowledge into our minds, Paul is actually talking about two different works of the Spirit of God. On the one hand, the Spirit of God is imparting a knowledge of God's mysteries to Paul, and he is speaking them forth. On the other hand, the Spirit of God is working in some people to give them a spiritual understanding so that when they hear the things of Paul, when they hear the things that Paul has proclaimed, they see it as wisdom. Paul calls those people earlier the mature. Now he's calling them spiritual. But it sort of comes down to the same issue. And Here is where we can see the two aspects of it. Paul's job is to explain spiritual things, that is, the things that have been imparted to him by the Spirit, to spiritual people, that is, those who have been prepared by the Spirit to understand and respond to the things that Paul proclaims. Okay, now, I recognize in this passage that there are a number of details that we would want to talk about. And I'm not claiming that I have said enough to convince you that this is the way we ought to look at it. But what I've tried to do is show you that there are at least significant reasons why we ought to consider very seriously that Paul is talking not about some sort of work of the Spirit that happens to every Christian, but that he's talking about these two things, as I've described. The knowledge that has been given him by the Spirit and the ability to receive and understand that knowledge that is given to the spiritual person. that there's a distinction. He's not claiming that every believer has knowledge poured into their head through the Spirit, but he's claiming that every believer, that every spiritual person, through the work of the Spirit, responds to the truths that are from God. It's not that the Spirit of God has poured out the mysteries of God into my mind, but he has worked on my heart such that when I see the mysteries of God as they are proclaimed in Paul's message, I can respond to them. However, if I were a natural man, they would be foolishness to me, and I would not respond to them at all. And so, coming to the last statement Paul makes then, for who has known the mind of the Lord that he should instruct him, but we have the mind of Christ? Here, he's taking off from a very famous statement from the Old Testament, who has known the mind of the Lord that he should instruct him? That idea that we as human beings get this idea somehow that we understand things so well that we could tell God how things ought to be going. You know, we have such a comprehension of things that God really ought to be consulting us on how things are running. And that sounds kind of silly in this context. We can all laugh, but the fact is that if you're anything like me, I have had that attitude often. I mean, it's so obvious to me how things ought to be. I don't know why God doesn't see it that way. I mean, it's just very common. And that's the statement from the Old Testament, sort of showing that up for the foolishness that it is. Who has known the mind of the Lord that he should instruct him? Who would have the audacity to claim to know what God is thinking and planning and doing? And that's what's at the heart of, when Paul quotes that, he's bringing out that, who would have the audacity to think that they know what God is thinking? Well, I think his answer is, well, I do. Because, not because I'm so smart or anything like that, but because I am a steward of the mysteries of God. God's hidden purposes he has revealed. And who is he revealing them through? He's revealing them through me. You want to know what to think of my message? My message is a declaration of the very mind of Christ himself. You want to know what Christ is up to? You want to know what he thinks? You want to know what he came to do? You want to know what his plans are, his purposes are? You want to know what he thinks of what's going on? I know. Because that's my job. I am a steward of the mysteries of God. We have the mind of Christ, then, is not a general statement about how Christians have been spiritually influenced, but it's a specific statement about how Paul has been given specific knowledge. When he says he has the mind of Christ, he actually means, not that Christ is thinking thoughts in his head or something like that, but that you want to know what Christ thinks? You know, what did Christ come to do? I wish he were here to ask him. Paul says, ask me, because I know. How is this all going to end? I wish I could ask Christ. Paul says, ask me, because I know. That's what he's trying to get across to the Corinthians in this section, I would argue. Their response of reluctance towards his message, that somehow he hasn't been eloquent enough, that he needs to defend himself and somehow demonstrate that he in fact is worthy to be listened to as an apostle. We know that's true as we go through the Corinthian letters. He actually makes it explicit that the Corinthians, some of them, are challenging even the very fact that he's an apostle at all. Well, here he's laying it out. Why should you listen to my message? Why are you foolish to think that I'm foolish? Because my message is wisdom from God. It has been given to me. I am speaking it out. The spiritual person responds to it and understands what I'm saying. The natural man, the one who has not been influenced by the Spirit of God, does not understand these things. But the fact is, I know the very mind and purposes of Christ himself because he has revealed his mind to me. He has come to me and made clear what it is he's doing and what he's all about. That's why you ought to be taking seriously what I'm saying. Okay, now as I said, I don't claim at this point that I have necessarily said enough to convince you that that's the way we ought to go. But that's not my purpose tonight. If you're unconvinced, that's all right. But what I want to do is trouble you with the idea that, you know, maybe at least I've been a little too hasty when I read this passage in thinking, oh yeah, that's us. We have the mind of Christ. Because it's not so cut and dry. It's, at the very least, we can say it's not immediately obvious that it has to be that way. Because Paul uses the word we to describe himself many, many times. And if we read we as Paul through here, it makes a great deal of sense, I would argue. And ultimately, I would argue it makes more sense than if we read it the other way, especially if we take the whole context of the letter. So, the point I want to get across to you tonight, whether you've followed exactly what I'm saying about this passage, I want to make the point to you, first of all, that this comes up a lot. We face this kind of issue a lot. You might think, you know, well, I don't have... Paul could be saying that, you know, that we have the mind of Christ because Jesus says that the Spirit was going to come and remind us of everything that he said. Okay, so isn't that the same as what he's saying here? Okay, actually, I'd like to encourage you to go and look at that passage because I don't think that passage is talking about us either. Well, what about when Jesus said, well, they're going to drag you before kings and stuff, and when you're there, don't prepare in advance what you're going to say because the Spirit will give you the message that you're supposed to proclaim. Isn't that the same kind of thing we're talking about here? Well, I know, I'm just a real pain, but I would encourage you to go look at that passage because I don't think that's talking about us either. So, and it's not because, I mean, maybe you can decide, that's Ron, he's just being stubborn, he doesn't want that to be true, and he's just waving it away. I would say no. I'm quite willing for it to be true, I just don't think it is true. If you look at those passages, they're not talking about us. Both of those passages, I would say, are talking about the apostles. They're talking about in essence, in all three of these passages, the same kind of mistake is being made. We jump in and think, yeah, that's us. But in fact, what's happening is it's talking about the work of the apostles. The Spirit of God came to Peter and John and reminded them what Jesus had said to them. They were going to go out and tell the world, this is the message of Jesus. How could they be adequate to do that? Because the Spirit of God came and reminded them and explained to them what it is he had said. They spent all those years walking with him, and it's pretty clear when you read the Gospels, they didn't understand almost anything he said. I mean, he said all those things, and Peter at one point says, you're the Christ, and he got that right. And that seems to be about the only thing that they got right the whole time. How could these guys go and explain Jesus to the world? They didn't get it. He should have gotten somebody else. But the fact is that after Jesus' death and resurrection, the apostles come on the scene with this brilliant understanding of the purposes of God, of the Old Testament, and how Jesus fits into it, and what Jesus said, and what he meant, and the implications of what he meant. Where'd that come from? Well, I think Jesus already told us that that was going to happen. The Spirit is going to come and give you an understanding of everything I said. That's not a promise to me, not in the same way. Is the Spirit at work in me, leading me towards understanding? Yeah. Do I have a promise that he's going to put in my mind a reminder of everything that Jesus said and an understanding of it? No, I don't think so. Okay. So, the main reason I wanted to make this say tonight what I've said is when we're reading the Bible, we need to pay close attention that we're seeing who is being addressed, who's being talked about here, and not just assume that it's talking about us. That's my first point. The other thing that I wanted to just mention, and then I'll be done, is I know that there are several sorts of responses you might have to what I've said here, and there are many. I'm not claiming that I know what your response is, but I have run across several. One might be, well, I don't understand what the big deal is. I mean, why are you talking about this? What difference does it make, really? Another response says, oh no, I understand the difference it makes. That's why I'm not buying it. You can't, Ron, look at what you've done. Before, I had a passage that talked about me, that told me that I had the Spirit of God imparting knowledge to me. This was exciting. This was like, if I could figure out how to do it, maybe I could get access to the mind of Christ that's in there somewhere. That's great. Now you've come along and you've explained it all away. And now it doesn't have anything to do with me. You're talking about Paul and he's dead. And so it's like, thanks very much, but now the Bible has become irrelevant to me. Whereas it used to be relevant, now this passage isn't relevant anymore. And I'm not making up a straw man when I say that. I've told the story a million times, but it's one of the turning points in my own life. There's another passage, another letter of Paul, where there is one of these we passages. And many years ago, as a young Christian, I was in a Bible study where we were looking at the passage, and it occurred to me that we were all talking about how, you know, we have this wonderful thing going on, and I was looking at it and it occurred to me, you know, if you follow it through, we is Paul. We is Paul. That's Paul. I. That's Paul. That's not us. That's Paul. And I thought that everybody would be delighted if I pointed out, hey, we haven't been reading this right. Let's think this over here. And I did. I pointed it out. And the leader of the Bible study, the adult leader of the Bible study that I was involved with, got really upset with me for saying this. And she said, hence my beginning of my talk, the Bible is God's love letter to me. If that's talking about Paul and not me, then it has no relevance to me. And that it's not, it can't be. What she said to me is, it can't be true that that's talking about Paul and not me, because this is God's love letter to me. What do I care about Paul? Is basically what it came down to. But see, that's where we have got to have a different mindset about this. I mean, whether I'm right or wrong about this passage, I think I am right about it, but you can, I would encourage you to think that over. Don't believe it because I say so. Just grant for a moment that I'm right about what this passage is getting at. It's crucially important what Paul is saying here. It's just a different message than what I thought it was saying. It's not saying that I have had this knowledge poured into my mind, but what it's saying is, this is one of those places where Paul is telling us, why should you be reading these letters that I wrote and putting so much weight on them? And if you've ever thought about that, why do I think that the Bible is what it is? Why do I read Paul's letters and try to figure out what he's saying? Well, because he claimed, as in right here, that God had opened up his hidden mysteries, the very purposes of God for all of creation, that God came into the world at a certain point and told us what it was he was doing and what it's all about. And he did it through certain people, and Paul is one of those people. The Spirit of God gave him an understanding of God's purposes, and he proclaimed that understanding. Why am I reading this letter he wrote to the Corinthians? Because he was a steward of the mysteries of God. That's incredibly important. It may not be as jazzy and exciting as the other idea, but the fact is, to my mind, it's very important. Knowing that has been a key, foundational, fundamental truth that I have thought about and wrestled with in my life as a believer. At those times, and there have been those times, when the Christian life is hard and I'm not sure I want to do it, one of the things that I have had to deal with is, but I can't just walk away from this, because this book is proclaiming the hidden purposes of God. Would you like to go talk to God and ask him what the heck's going on? Well, Paul knew, and he talked about it. And that's a big deal. So I would encourage you, if it seems like I'm taking something away, in this process that we're going through here. I would encourage you that, to my mind, if I'm taking something away, I'm giving you back something that's even more important, I think. Okay, so I went a long time. For those of you who are new around here, I rarely ramble on and on. So this was a real unusual situation tonight, but we'll take some questions and comments.
This is maybe a silly question, but Carl did use I.
Yes.
He had access to the word I.
Yes, he did.
So why would he flip-flop between we and I, and is there something I don't know about Greek that could add to this
right.
obviously strange...
Right. Well, as I'm answering this question, I do want you to be aware of the things I was pointing you to, and there's plenty more. There's no question that he did this. And in fact, we can see examples that are very clear to everyone where he's using I and he goes to we and it's the same. I mean, he's still talking about himself. So he did do that. Why did he do it? There are several possibilities, and I still have not quite decided for myself how to put that together. This one that I showed you tonight is one that I had actually... You know, for all the years that I've been talking about this stuff, I have never actually done what I did for this tonight. You know, I've got the software now to be able to do this sort of thing. I just sat down and said, I want to see all the places in Paul's letters where a verb was used in the first person plural, we, and came up with, I forget, there were a lot of them, 200 something, I forget, quite a few. And then I just went through the list and kind of sorted out, there are a lot of them where we, it was not this sort of thing, but I kind of pulled this stuff out here. And some of them were ones that I had not really looked at or thought about before. And the one that was very striking to me this time was the one I pointed out to you where he talks about how I boasted to Titus about you, and then he talks about our boasting before Titus proved to be the truth. And I can't put that together any way that makes it so that somehow he's switched to talking about a different set of boasting where some other people were boasting with him or something. I mean, it's just and there are a number of examples like that. So, why would he do such a thing? One possibility is that literally it was a part of Greek style that was very common so that it would be just a natural thing to do. It was not natural for us to do, but that he would switch that way somewhat easily and unconsciously because it was common to do so.
Can you make an argument for maybe other writings other than the Bible that was kind of style of writing was?
Well, yes. I mean, up to a point. I'm not prepared to make, you know, like to write a doctoral dissertation on the use of we, yeah, in Greek literature. But yes, it's certainly true that this happened in other places. The phrase, the royal we, was not coined for Paul's writings. I mean, you find it in a lot of ancient writings. So there is that. But there's also, in some of the places where he uses the we, it seems to me quite possible that he may, at least a little bit in his mind, be influenced by the fact that he is talking about things that are true of the apostolic community in general. That when he says I, he's talking specifically about when I was with you. But when he says we, there he may have something that has sort of brought other people to mind. Not we Christians, but we proclaim this gospel. We have been given grace and apostleship. Is it that he sort of has in mind himself in the company of the other apostles have been given grace and apostleship? I don't know. That seems to me like a possibility.
So not all these examples are necessarily by. He could be talking about apostles in general.
Well, I would say they're not so general as in to say, in these examples, he is at the center of it. I mean, it's really, this is a letter from Paul who has been given grace and apostleship to do this stuff. If in his mind, when he says we, he's sort of evoking the other apostles, he's not doing it very strongly, because the issue is really, who am I? Who is this guy that's talking to you? In many of these examples, if we were to go to look at them, it doesn't exactly work to just put all the apostles in, because even in these, it's too specific. It is focusing too much on him. But for our purposes, it doesn't really matter whether it's all the apostles or not, whether I would be the best translation in every spot. The key thing for us to have in mind is, does we always mean we Christians, we all of us? Whether it's I, Paul, or we apostles, that's still a distinct group that he may be saying something that's different than he would be saying about Christians in general.
Okay, for verse 15, when it says the spiritual man makes judgments about all things, mm-hmm. but he himself is not subject to any man's judgment, would that be Paul talking about himself as an apostle, and saying that he is not under the judgment of the Corinthians who are saying this or that or whatever, because his particular understanding is from God? And then he goes on to quote, "For who has known the mind of God?" And he says, "Maybe I have."
Yeah, I don't think that under judgment is the best way to translate that there. The same verb is used three times in that section. He says, he who is spiritual, in 14, they are foolishness to him and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually, and in my translation it says appraised. What does yours say for that verse? Discerned. Okay, well, see that discerned there, that's the same, if I'm remembering correctly, that's the same verb in these three things. So we would want to kind of translate it the same way. They are spiritually discerned, but he who is spiritual discerns all things, yet he himself is discerned by no man. I think that the idea that he's getting at there is, it's close to what you were saying, but what he's saying is the spiritual person, the things of God are comprehended, are understood, are correctly evaluated. They're looked at and understood to be wise by the spiritual person. The spiritual person, the person in whom the Spirit is working, is in a position to understand and evaluate, discern everything. But he himself is not, he himself will not be understood by everyone else. Now, when he says by no man, I think in the context he has to really mean the natural man. That the spiritual man will understand, but he will not be understood. And he is implying himself a little bit there. I mean, that if...
That would make it fit with, right. with the rest of the context.
Right. That the problem is, what he's saying is, the spiritual person is going to comprehend, but he will not be comprehended by people who are not spiritual. And unfortunately, we have a situation here where the Corinthians are not comprehending Paul. That is, they're not evaluating him correctly. They're looking at him and seeing him as being negligible, as someone they can discount.
So Paul is actually referring to the fact that they are natural men.
Yes, or at least raising the question, what has created this situation? How is it that this is going on? And of course, remember, when I say the Corinthians, I'm libeling them. This is actually a mixed group. I think some of them are mature people. They are people of faith. They follow and understand Paul. But there is a group in Corinth that is very much against him. And that's why the Corinthian letters seem sort of schizophrenic. At one thing, point he'll say something really nice about them, and then at the next minute he'll turn around and be blasting them with, you know, well, I think it's because it's this mixed group. Some of them are believers and some of them are acting very much as if they're not. And he's dealing with different aspects of it there. Okay, so my purpose... Oh, go ahead.
I had a question. In the royal we, like with the kings, weren't they? Wasn't there a belief, too, that there were... I mean, they were like the mouthpiece of God, or that there was some kind of... They were practically a deity themselves. And so when they spoke, there was... Would the we represent like an authority thing? Like, is, you know, I'm kind of speaking on behalf
right.
of... And if that is accurate, would... I mean, can that be applied to some of, like, Paul's perhaps use of we, is that there, he's designating a, not like me myself, but also like, I speak this with the authority of Christ, or?
Well, that's an interesting question. I can't really answer it because I don't know enough to know for sure that the truly royal we meant that. It may have. It may have implied something like that, but I'm not sure whether it did or not. I'm a little hesitant to say that would be behind Paul's we, because even at the same time, Paul, on the one hand, makes very audacious claims about his authority, but at the same time, he's also very humble about how, in a way, this really isn't me. You know? I don't know. Whether... I'm trying to picture whether he would think about things in that way. I find it easier to imagine that he would group himself with the other apostles than that he would say, you know, me and Jesus. You know, we're kind of like that. I know that's caricaturing what you're saying, but yeah, I don't know. I'd have to think about that. Both parts of that I'm not sure about, but it's possible. I mean, we're looking for some explanation for why he uses the we, and that would...
I don't know if this would be helpful or not, but we do have a common everyday way that we use a plural instead of a singular that is becoming more and more apparent when we use it for a different purpose. We're trying to find a neuter. But all the time in English, we name a singular person and we use a plural to describe
right.
it. If you could give an example, I can give
it. Right. Do you know what Robbie's talking about? We have, especially in a climate where there's an increased sensitivity about the gender of words, we are making up a neuter singular. If I want to talk about someone, I say, they did it. Not because there were more than one of them, but because if I say he did it, then I'm implying that it wasn't a female. If I say she did it, I'm implying that it wasn't a male. And I don't really mean to imply any of those things. It's just someone. You know, if we're talking about, you know, if anyone, you know, was to eat at this particular restaurant, they would find out pretty quick that the food's pretty bad. That we use that in common speech all the time now because we don't want to say he, which used to be generic. We used to use he generically to mean... If I'm not specifying the gender, it would just mean whoever. But that's becoming unacceptable, so we're more and more using they in that spot. Well, there's no significance to the plurality in that. I mean, the fact that it's plural means nothing. It's just that we needed a word to use, and we didn't have a singular that we felt comfortable with, and we tried making up words, then they sounded really strange, and what's happened is we just use they.
I thought we used y'all for that.
Yeah. Right. Some of us do. Yeah, so that's a good example. Now, it's a different reason, and it may not... But it does show you that language is quite pliable. You know, if you... Whatever lesson you might have gotten in your grammar studies, you know, that somehow grammar is this set of rules that, you know, are sort of ironclad rules that tell you exactly what's going on. There's no language on the face of the earth that has ever been like that. Language is always flexible and moves in various directions. And the Greek of the New Testament was just the same. If you've ever heard, some people will say things like, well, the reason that God chose to write the New Testament in Greek is that Greek is the most precise language, and, you know, it's just, you know, it can't be misunderstood because it is so precise in the way it puts things together. That's just ask any of the students at Gutenberg here who are studying Greek, and they'll tell you, no, that's not true. So, language conventions come about in a lot of different ways. Okay, well, I think maybe we'll... Oh, yeah, this will be the last question.
Well, I was wondering whether or not... So I think Bill, to my mind, Bill's right on the nose, and that I believe in the same manner that Jacob and Israel were the same person, that Paul is using the we and the I on occasions to state when he believes he's not entirely with authority. And I think that that would actually also put that same mind of humbleness in stating, for instance, when I came to you, first and spoke to you with words of the flesh, as it were, or when he says, even that he, when he's speaking to people who do not have the Spirit, he says as an I versus as a we, when I think that I believe that when he speaks in the we, he's speaking of himself and the Spirit, or himself fulfilled with the Spirit, and using that same revelation that he's had by the Spirit to speak what the Spirit would have him speak.
Well, it's possible. When I look at him saying, I boasted about Titus to you, and our boasting turned out to be true.
So I boast because I, human, have the ability to boast, and I vilify. But it was true. We showed it to be true. In that exact same sentence, because it was true, it was of the Spirit. It was actually of the Holy Spirit.
Okay, well, I think that's reading too much into it. But it's possible. I'm not saying it's not possible. But we would have to sit down and look at all of the examples and see if that held up. There I meant we. But, and now we're going to stop.